Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you expert insights from a multidisciplinary team on novel immunotherapeutic approaches for non-driver mutation metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Plus, hear from a patient advocate on the importance of shared decision-making and how to best support patients throughout their treatment journey. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from AstraZeneca and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, an oncology pharmacist and a medical oncologist review the mechanisms of action and latest data for novel immunotherapeutic approaches to overcome resistance to current standard of care immunotherapy for non-driver mutation metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.
Hello, my name is Dr. Lisa Holly. I'm an oncology pharmacist and professor of clinical pharmacology at the University of Connecticut and the UConn Health NEAG Comprehensive Cancer Center located in the United States. It's a pleasure to introduce Professor Raffaele Califano, who's a medical oncologist at the Christian Manchester University Hospital in the United Kingdom, to this conversation with me today. Today, we'll talk about approaches to overcoming resistance to standard of care immunotherapy for patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer who do not have driver mutations. We've come a long way with the use of immunotherapy in the treatment of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. It really has revolutionized the care of our patients without oncologic driver mutations. But we do know that patients can either have primary resistance, meaning that they really don't respond to immunotherapy when used in the first line setting, or they can acquire resistance over time. There are a number of mechanisms that go into developing that either primary or acquired resistance, and we're really starting to learn about those mechanisms in great detail. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Califano, what types of strategies we already are studying or have in place to overcome these types of resistance?
Thank you. The main strategies are looking at combination of therapeutic approaches. And the first one to be trialed is the combination of PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade plus CTLA-4 with drugs such as nivolumab plus ipilimumab or durvalumab plus tremelimumab, which are now approved options in some healthcare settings. Together with that, another potential approach is to give two or more different kind of immune checkpoint inhibitors, which are tackling other checkpoints different than PD-L1 or PD-1 or CTLA-4. And these are, for example, LAG-3 inhibitors, TIM-3 inhibitors, or also TIGIT. Very interesting from a biological point of view is the potential association or combination of antiangiogenic agents with immune checkpoint blockade, because we know that, for example, VEGF inhibition can reduce the apoxia and can also facilitate the migration of the T cells into the tumor and therefore increasing the immune response, or potential combination with PARP inhibition, which is basically DNA damaging agents. So to try and enhance the direct killing of the cancer cells, release of neoantigen, and therefore increase the immune response. And certainly very important, and this is something that we already use in the locally advanced curative setting, is the potential impact and role of combining immunotherapy with radiotherapy, as we know that radiotherapy may potentially manipulate the tumor microenvironment, making the tumor microenvironment more favorable in terms of mounting an immune response. There is some data that if you expose tumors to radiotherapy, you may increase the PD-L1 expression together with other cytokine release, including interferon gamma and so on, which theoretically may promote the immune response. And a clear benefit has been shown in the locally advanced setting post-concurrent chemoradiotherapy with durvalumab, which is now approved all over the world. If you want to focus on the ongoing strategies which remain investigational, certainly the studies evaluating LAG-3 blockade with drugs called Eftilam GMOD alpha plus Pembro, for example, in in the TACTI-002 study or the relativity study looking at relatimab, again, another anti-LAG3 plus nivolumab. These have shown in the early phase setting some interesting results in the pre-treated population, and there are studies ongoing looking at first-line setting or post-chemo-IO, so let's say secondary resistance setting. Together with that, we then have the anti-TIGIT compounds. There was a lot of enthusiasm a number of years ago when there were phase two studies reporting tiragolumab, for example, which is an anti-TIGIT plus atezolizumab in the non-small cell lung cancer pre-treated population, showing potentially increasing response rate and progression-free survival. The enthusiasm at present with the anti-TIGIT has been dampened a bit by some results in the randomized setting phase three with the addition of tiragolumab plus atezo versus atezolizumab alone. And also disappointing results have been reported in the small cell lung cancer setting. So at present, as a research community, there is a bit less interest in the TIGIT. But I think this doesn't mean that it's not a strategy that works. I don't think we are very good at designing the right study more than anything else. Together with that, another interesting strategy is the targeting TIM-3. And again, there's a number of studies ongoing looking at cobolimab, for example, which is a TIM-3 inhibitor plus PD-1 inhibition. And again, the combination of the TIM-3 plus PD-1 inhibitor plus chemotherapy in the phase 2 to 3 studies, which are now ongoing. And it is very important to see how these studies will read out, because inevitably when you have a small early phase study, there's a lot of selection bias that may influence the outcome of these results. And unfortunately, until you see the phase 3 randomized trials, you can't really bank on these results. I think another important strategy, which is very novel, is the use of bispecific antibodies, which are drugs which are engineered to target two, for example, checkpoint at the time, and potential compounds are MEDI5752, which is anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 in the same drug, or AZD2936, which is anti-TIGIT plus an anti-PD-1, again, now in phase two setting. And kind of compounds that I think are very interesting are also the antibody drug conjugates, which are molecules which are composed by two parts, if you want to make it simple. One is the drug that will bind to the ligand, and then you have a payload which will be released once the drug is in the tumor or attached to the tumor. And usually this is a cytotoxic drug. For example, we have two drugs in phase 2 and 3 development at the moment. One is sacituzumab govitecan, where the payload is these are TROP2 inhibitors, and the other one is datopotamab deruxtecan. They both have in common that they are TROP2 inhibitors, and the payload is a topoisomerase inhibitor, so direct cytotoxic killing of the cells. But again, it's still early days to say if this will be a winning strategy in clinical practice, but lots to be excited about.
And I think the novel targets that we are evaluating in a non-small cell lung cancer setting are also very interesting, being able to target the different checkpoints along with PD-1 and CTLA-4 that we already know are quite effective and non-small cell lung cancer. So I really appreciate you providing that information to us, and hopefully we'll be able to overcome resistance that we've seen so far. I'm wondering, in your own practice, with the combination therapies that are already approved, nivolumab, ipilimumab, or durvalumab and tremelimumab, do you use those in practice, and how do you incorporate that into your paradigm of treatment?
So thank you. So that's a very important question. So in the setting where I practice, I don't have any approval in terms of reimbursement in the public health setting for combination of PD-1 or PD-1 inhibitors plus CTLA-4. So either nivolumab plus ipilimumab or durvalumab plus tremelimumab in the advanced setting. What I think, you know, in principle is that these are interesting strategies. What is difficult is to find the right patients to give it, because these studies have demonstrated that dual blockade was better than chemotherapy at the time they were designed, which was the standard of care. And the real question is dual blockade better than, let's say, chemotherapy plus an anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1? And can I, therefore, justify the addition of the CTLA-4-related adverse events to this strategy? The short answer is we don't know, because most of the studies that were designed, you know, tested against chemotherapy, and that's unfortunately due to the time of the study design. I think there will be a role for some patients to have dual blockade. There are some longer follow-up reports that suggest that you may derive even longer benefit in terms of overall survival. At present, what I find difficult is to decide which are the subgroup of patients from a clinical point of view, but also from a biomarker point of view, where I should try it. But again, with more and more trials reporting on this strategy, we should be able to refine it over the next couple of years.
Yeah, those are all excellent points. I think that we have the same sort of conversations within our own practice here. I think the other sort of interesting thing now is trying to figure out, as we treat patients potentially in locally advanced disease with durvalumab, if they present later on with metastatic disease, how does immunotherapy play a role on that? And how do we determine who might have some resistance already to immunotherapy? And should we try some of these emerging regimens if they become effective and available? Do you have any thoughts on that?
And there's a number of questions of what to do at progression. So should we re-challenge these patients with immunotherapy, yes or no? If yes, what should be your progression-free interval? 6 months, a year, I think is all something that you can pull out of a hat, because nobody knows. And what is also at a biological level going to drive the potential response to what you do next? How can you ascertain that the biology in certain patients will be more favorable to rechallenge compared to not? And on top of that, you need to take into account the potential biomarker status of that tumor.
Well, thank you very much for your expert opinion and all of the great conversation that we had today. And also thanks to the audience for watching the video. You can find out more about immunotherapeutic approaches for the treatment of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer without driver mutations in the other short videos in this activity. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on non-small cell lung cancer on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com. Don't forget, there are 3 other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.